there. You're with Extra with me, Geraldine Doog, bringing you just some of the people and the stories that excite me each week. So great to have your company for the next half hour. Now to A Foreign Affair, our monthly panel where we take a look at events worldwide during the past month that become the focus of attention, or maybe should have become the focus of attention if we could turn our gaze away from the very local. We invite guests to nominate an event or an idea that has resonated with them and then hopefully to intrigue the rest of us. So it's my pleasure to welcome Caitlin Byrne, who's the director of the Griffith Asia Institute, also Francois Rivasseau, a visitor to Australia who's been here for that space conference we mentioned earlier in the program. He's the special envoy for space and head of security policy and space for something called the European External Action Service, and he's based in Brussels. And finally, Mike Smith, the national president of the UN Association of Australia, the UNAA, a retired Army Major General and proud peacekeeper from duty in Timor, amongst others. A very warm welcome to A Foreign Affair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the invitation.
First, to the power of sport to influence politics both domestically and internationally. And Caitlin, you've nominated the dispute in America where hundreds of athletes and dozens of team owners have decided to, I heard the phrase, take the kneel, kneel, sit, link arms or otherwise protest during the national anthem against police brutality towards African Americans, actions that enraged their President Donald Trump.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
Now, what's intriguing, Caitlin, I suppose, is threefold. How this is growing, and it's so visual too. Secondly, how it's seemed to me a trap for the president. But do you think it has much resonance elsewhere around the world, or is it seen as sort of only in America?
I think this is part of a growing renaissance for sport. And, you know, we've had a bit of discourse in Australia recently in the last couple of days that sport is sport. Well, you know, I think we can challenge that. And sport and politics have really been connected since time immemorial. You know, we can go right back to the ancient city-states and see how sport was used as a mechanism both to cohere people, bring them together, unite them in a competition, a friendly competition, but also can be a tool to divide. I'm really interested in this from a diplomacy aspect, and I think diplomacy itself is changing, and we're seeing these different dimensions to diplomacy within America at the moment. And I think it's emblematic of a changing world, the role of people in that world and the right to expression.
Well, we do have an Australian sports diplomacy strategy we discovered 2015 to 18. So do you honestly think that sport can open doors that maybe more orthodox diplomacy can't?
Look, I think it's really important not to overstate the role of sport, but it is part of this growing expansion, innovation within the diplomatic space. It's like an enabler, if you like, in cases sometimes where traditional diplomacy doesn't work. And even, you know, thinking about some of the trickier examples in our region, Moon Jae-in, President of South Korea, the Republic of Korea, unveiled the Olympic medals that will be used at the Winter Olympics in Korea. And he foreshadowed the fact that, you know, the 2020 Summer Olympics will be held in Tokyo, the 2022 Winter Olympics in China. And for him, he said, this is an opportunity for us to rethink peace, to use sport as an instrument of diplomacy for peace in our region.
Do you think it can work?
If I may jump in, I would just confirm. And in France, in Europe, I think there's not so much attention given to the last declaration in the US of the President of the United States. But what is important for us, for example, and which raises a lot of attention, is the fact that Paris will go to the next Olympic Games in 2024. Mm. And people enjoy in the streets, and this has made the first lines of the media and contributed not only to the diplomacy, but also to the optimism in the country itself. You know, there is a new feeling of optimism in Europe and in France now, and sport is really an important part of it. Obviously, myself, I practice rugby, and when I speak about rugby, Australia and New Zealand are always diminishing a bit my optimism.
Well, even in the rugby space, you know, the opportunity that rugby has been giving to women, and I'm thinking in particular about the PNG Australia women's match that was held just on the weekend that's gone in Port Moresby, Australia, the Gillaroos won. But that's a really important symbol of how the landscape is changing and how women are playing a role in this
Mike,
landscape.
Have you seen this in your work?
Yes, I have indeed. And I guess from my time, though, in places like Papua New Guinea, Cambodia and Timor-Leste, I'm seeing sport also having another role, and that is for young people to help them with leadership, and otherwise they could be off the streets or on the streets doing other things, and it brings them together. And I don't think we've been doing enough of that, and we're very good at that. I mean, sport has always been in diplomacy at some extent or not. I mean, you know, look at rugby and South Africa.
Look at the Munich Olympics.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking of. But there's very practical stuff on development that I think that we, Australia could do more on because we're good at it.
So if you think about our singing diplomat, isn't it Fred Smith sort of thing? I mean, I wonder whether we need much more overt, not laughing at this. I mean, I know the Lowy Institute has been on about this for quite a while.
Yeah.
Well, it sort of gets traction, doesn't it, Caitlin? But then everybody decides it's a bit ancillary.
And I think we have to be really careful about placing sport, you know, it's one of many levers in diplomacy today in the contemporary networked world that we live in. And I think a lot of attention goes to these big events, the major events, the Olympics, the Commonwealth Games, the Asian Cup, and they all have a place, but we can't forget, you know, the relational aspect, the bringing communities together, the promoting healthy lifestyles, and that's an issue in the Pacific as well.
Certainly is.
That we're seeing sport play a role in.
But if it goes pear-shaped, I suppose, Mike, if somebody suddenly says something that is totally undiplomatic because actually they're not trained diplomats, does it matter?
Well, it could if they said the wrong thing and got people offside, but it wouldn't take much to train them up beforehand because their focus is actually on sport. I remember in Cambodia where we had a person at the embassy, the doctor's wife actually, and she got basically the stadium that had not been used since Pol Pot time basically being used again with little athletics. And people came from everywhere.
Wow.
It was sensational. One lady in Australia with a, you know, a little bit of funding from the embassy. It was fantastic.
It's really interesting when you say that, Mike, as well, because we see other great powers who are operating in our region. China is an example, investing a great deal of money in the infrastructure of sport as a means to gain influence. And I think, you know, again, we have to really find those critical distinctions in where sport can be very useful, where it promotes broader interests, or where it's sitting alongside national interests.
Very interesting. So, Francois, you're visiting, if I can move to your thoughts, for this big conference on space, at which the federal government committed to the creation of a long-called-for national space agency. Here's our Education Minister, Simon Birmingham.
It will be an Australian space agency with Australian interests seeking to generate and drive investment in Australia, research and scientific capability in Australia, and ensure that across the different paradigms of space, we can be at the forefront as a nation in seizing those opportunities.
Now, I know, Francois, you specialise in understanding how the space domain has such resonance for our terrestrial global village, how it affects international security and also cyber risks. Do you wish it was discussed differently? Because honestly, I think for most of us, it still feels very arcane.
Yeah, true. I am a kind of diplomat for the European Union. And within the European Union, the same remark is good also. Space is an issue either for fans, reading fanzine or fiction books, or looking at movies and games, or for a very restricted number of very serious people who discuss engines, astronomy and all that. And in the middle, between these two groups, the great public is not taking enough interest in space. And why this will change. I'm absolutely convinced this will change in the next years, because people will have to realize that their daily life depends more and more from space.
Well, does it really? Persuade me.
Yeah, I try. First of all, when you take your car, you usually have now a GPS. GPS is a space system. If the satellites of GPS or the ground segment of GPS is disrupted in a way or another, you will not know where to go. But it will be even worse just talking about GPS, because the universal time in the world is given by the satellites, and particularly the GPS satellites. So if you want to buy something in the stock exchange, the time of your buy is given by the satellite. And so the price you buy at is determined by the second where you buy it in, given by the satellites. If the satellite doesn't work, you cannot know the price of what you are buying, so stock exchanges are paralyzed. Banking will have problem also. A number of very technological functions in hospitals, for example, are also calibrated along the time, which is again given by satellite.
And what about our electricity? I mean, the more you talk, of course, the more I realize the risks if this is interrupted nefariously.
Exactly. Just for the navigation satellites, you know that there are four systems. Four or five systems of navigation satellites, the GPS, the Chinese Baidu, the European Galileo, which will be like Baidu, fully operational worldwide in 3 years, and the Russian GLONASS plus Japanese system, which operates in this area also. So these systems are redundant, which is a good thing, but if they were to stop, for example, it's between 10 and 15% of the economy of Europe which would go, and I guess the proportion should be rather similar in Australia. There are many services that today depend on space, particularly communication, radio, television, but also localization and observation.
So, therefore, does this mean that international security is really very much in the hands of those systems working properly?
Yes, absolutely. You know that we have now in Europe a kind of renewed interest for working together, France and Germany. And they made a very important declaration in July about their common objectives in defense and security. And one of them was securing the operation of satellites, because now satellites have become one of the most critical infrastructure in the world.
And is it, and by and large, a lot of interaction, good cooperation, or are you sort of getting outliers? I'm thinking of Russia, obviously.
No, we have increasing good cooperation, because satellite action is global, so there are global interests in that. But however, they are vulnerable. They are vulnerable to space debris. You have a lot of debris of former satellites which are orbiting the Earth and which are running satellites at risk. You have also cyber risks. You have to protect the satellites against cyber attacks.
So is that the biggest risk?
I would say it has not yet materialized, but it's a very high potential risk, particularly if you take into account that most of the satellites today running in the sky, that you can see at night as a little star, they have been conceived and launched 10 or 15 years ago, at a time where cyber risks were very small, and so the protection of these satellites against cyber risks at that time was low.
Right.
They have not been designed with cybersecurity in mind. So now it is we have to make a special effort to protect them.
Have we got any evidence that jihadists or sort of groups like jihadists have got any expertise about this?
No, we have no. No, I would not make you too worried. Till now, we have no specific indication of cyber terrorism, and even less of cyber terrorism oriented towards satellites. Now, jihadists use internet and are very happy to have working satellites to make their propaganda online. You know?
Yes, I suppose that's true.
Unfortunately, yes. But this is a potential risk in the future, which will exist soon. In 5 years, we will have between 5 and 10 billions of connected objects which will work thanks to satellites, thanks to internet, because internet and satellites work together. You will have refrigerators with computers which will be timed by satellites. You will have maybe cars, you know, maybe automatic cars. You will have many objects, toys.
Electricity systems, I would have thought, are pretty important here.
Absolutely. Energy grids are already controlled by electronics. And we have seen a lot of attacks against energy grid in the last years, yes.
There are some interesting issues here as well, sorry to jump in, but for diplomacy and the kind of stakeholders that are involved in this, the global Internet of Things, and, you know, bringing private corporations, for example, into understanding or setting out the norms and standards for governance. You know, this is really new territory for the diplomatic community. Well, reasonably new territory anyway.
That is a perfect segue Mike wants to discuss, Mike Smith, this much used phrase, which is about as exciting as watching raindrop, the international rules-based order. Now, I mean, Mike, you believe that this should be recognised for a vital phrase. Here's our Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, giving it another run earlier this month in the United Nations General Assembly.
There have been times over the past seven decades when the rules-based order has been under pressure. We are now in a time when the challenges to that order are increasing. The United Nations Security Council is the custodian of international peace and security. Yet the authority of the Council is being challenged, undermined, even ignored. The most egregious example is North Korea.
And she went on again to pledge our support for the rules-based order. Now, Mike, make it exciting for me, please. I mean, I am excited, but it's stripped of emotion, isn't it?
Yeah, well, of course it is. And from my perspective, when I kept hearing this statement everywhere, I thought, well, what is the rules-based international order? Because it seems to me that nation states use it to their advantage when they want to use it. But actually, what it turns out when we analysed it in UNAA was that the very centre of it is the United Nations in all sorts of ways that people don't even think about, like postal and telecommunications and aviation. And yet our Defence Review in 2015 mentioned the rules-based global order, I think they called it, something like 46 times, and hardly mentioned the United Nations at the centre of it. And so my fear is that in a highly disrupted world that we're in at the moment, where power politics is taking on a pretty ugly guise, back to what it was sort of like before the UN was formed, that we do risk losing this rules-based international order. And what this really means is that member states have to support the UN more than they have been doing. Some member states have to support. And we have to try and find common ground. And this is very important, of course, because diplomacy is about, at the end of the day, is about more jaw and less war.
Yeah, well, we've been talking about some of this with our former Foreign Minister Gareth Evans earlier on Saturday Extra, and that great phrase that I think Doug Hammarskjöld, the man who died, he was at the helm of the United Nations, that the United Nations was never intended to bring us to heaven, but it was to save us from hell. So is it, Mike Smith, that people don't grasp how rules do bring peace and a yield for us all? Is that it?
I think that's part of it. But also it's the way it's interpreted by nation states when they want to. So, for example, we're very strong on the rules-based international order for access in the South China Sea, but we've been through a torturous process with Timor-Leste over the Timor Gap. Oil thing. Mm-hmm. But thankfully we've handled that pretty well, I think, in the finish. It's come out okay. So the rules-based international order is really about saying, hey, these are the general rules, we'll have different opinions about them, but let's diplomatically try and negotiate our way through them rather than going to war at the end of the day. That's what it's all about and why it's... And don't forget, the UN was set up at the end of the Second World War on basically the bodies of 60 million people. You know, we didn't want to go back there again. I'm not sure today we could write a charter as good as what that charter was in 1946.
Now, Francois, listening to this as a Frenchman, That's a powerful statement, isn't it, about the fate of Europe and beyond, which some people are suggesting has been somewhat forgotten in these in this latest round of populism and anxiety.
Well, first of all, I very much agree with Mark, and Europe and Australia, I think, share more than many exactly the same ambitious conception of the United Nations. We are, in Australia, in Europe, extremely strong supporters of the United Nations, because if you want to live in a world governed by rule of law, we have no choice, and we would not be able to rewrite the UN Charter today, indeed. About Europe, yes, you
that
have
seen... That is actually a very interesting test, and I'm just listening to both of you. That is a fascinating observation. You don't really think you could write that charter today, Francois, in the same way.
Well, unless we would have 60 million dead, exactly as Mark said. And fortunately, it's not the case. So we would have difficulties. If this is a text which has been written between the lies, don't forget. At that time, all the members of the United Nations were allied. And there are still in the charter some completely outdated phrases about former enemy states. So today, this feeling of being allied to the whole world is
allies.
Not exactly the same. We have more a feeling of global solidarity against some risk like climate change, environment, global crime, drugs, problems caused by displacement of populations, refugees. All that is something which almost every country has to face.
And Caitlin, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say something really similar. The pressures and the issues we're dealing with don't sit in the domain of just one or even just a few governments, and they sit in the domain of governments, of business, of community organisations, of publics. So actually negotiating this very different world, a very different world to when the UN came into being, takes a lot of effort and resource. And I think sometimes we look to the UN to be the silver bullet and forget, you know, about the radical incrementalism, I guess, is a term that Peter Varghese used to use.
As the head of Department of Foreign Affairs.
That's right, you know, and the importance of these very small steps but this constant process of negotiation.
It's funny, Brett Stevens, who was, I think, we heard him on Radio National Breakfast, the works for the New York Times now, Mike Smith, he spoke at a Big Lowy dinner recently to award a prize to foreign coverage by Australian journalists, and he said that what he thinks is staggering is that America at the moment, particularly Donald Trump, doesn't seem to grasp what it has gained from a rules-based order. That if you have clear set-out rules, now, of course, it's been in America's interest, I accept that, everybody sort of more or less benefits more than if there's much more negotiation and it's fluid.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely correct observation by Brett. I think what might have happened since President Trump came to office is that he's realised this, because his address to the United Nations during the General Assembly was very different in a way from what he was saying when he was first elected about the United Nations I'm talking about. And, you know, he made points about the United Nations needs to reform. We all know that. And the Secretary General's That's his big agenda, to try and reform the United Nations. It's not perfect, but without the United Nations, we'd be a lot worse off. That's the bottom line.
Look, just before we do go and leave Foreign Affair this month, I really do want to go back to that German election, because the significance, I think, is dawning on everyone. I think there was sort of unnecessary panic about the numbers for the far right for the first time since 45. But what people are commenting on now, particularly, say, Laura Tingle writing in the Financial Review, is that it has dented the legitimacy and the sheer power of this woman who appeared to become almost the de facto leader of the Western world, Angela Merkel. Now, I wonder how a Frenchman like you, Francois, reads it, given that your president, Emmanuel Macron, was starting to aim very high in his language, saying that Europe wasn't burdened by its history. I wonder how you think French people will receive this.
The first thing that we receive is that Angela Merkel has been re-elected for the fourth time. it's unique almost in history to have the same leader elected four times in a row. There has precedent in the German history. Adenauer and Kohl have been also elected four times. So she's equaling the highest possible mark in the German leader's history. And that's the first thing we note. It is true that she will not have a majority. She had not in the last phase. The point is, she will have to form a government. So Angela Merkel today is obliged to look at another combination,
yes,
together with Liberals and Greens.
It's more what it does to the atmospherics, I suppose, of that sense of being able to take all before you, which she had. And it just seems to me Macron is actually really a lot more ambitious, and he might be out on his own a little bit more.
Well, you know, the fact is that as many times in the past, Europe is facing hard choice. Today we are in a political situation where President Macron feels strongly, and I think he has been given a clear mandate by the French population for that, feels clearly that we have to overcome the crisis caused by populism, mostly by the migrant crisis caused by instability around Europe, and the difficulty to have economic growth dynamic again and inequalities growing. And he believes that Europe has to protect better the citizen,
yes,
to defend better Europe, to change and to increase its role. And he said it very clearly. But you know, in the European system, you set up the objectives, and after that, it takes some time
to sort of implement. Well, that, yes. In fact, I mean, I'll just one of the other things to you, Caitlin, that Laura Tingle has been writing about is how one talks to the electorate if you're a leader these days. And what has been so interesting in Laura's view is that Angela Merkel didn't really know whether to take on, you know, front on issues of immigration and worries and anxieties, exactly what Macron did do. So she sort of pulled back, and she's probably been punished for it.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, people are increasingly distrustful of politicians, politics, institutions. So there is a real need to open up the conversation. And it brings us back actually to the starting point with Trump and the way that he has responded to the current campaign by the NFL players in the US. And, you know, this really bombastic response is it does seem to be backing him into a corner. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out. But this is a real challenge of leadership today.
Yeah, I guess I see that what's been happening across the Western world is largely about large parts of the population in all of the countries, including here in Australia, feeling as if they've been ignored or forgotten. They've been told that this globalisation is good for them, and they're saying at the end of it, but we're not getting that much out of it. And so the way politicians talk to their electorates is very important, but in all of the countries, there's a greater gap, I think, occurring between the haves and the have-nots, this inequality issue. And when people are feeling as if politicians are not giving them what they want, they go to...
Well, not even talking about it. That's the issue.
Correct.
That everyone sort of said, oh, yeah, well, look, if we go there, it's tricky, and we'll bring demons out of the closet and so on. But to ignore it seems to be having an impact, which is, well, arguably not healthy for democracy. Thank you very much indeed, because we've ranged far and wide, which is what we like here on Foreign Affair. Michael Smith, Francois Rivasseau, welcome to Australia again, and Professor Caitlin Byrne, thank you all for your time.
Thanks, Geraldine. Great to be here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Geraldine.
And Major General retired Michael Smith is from the UNWA, Francois Rivasseau, the Special Envoy for Space and Head of Security Policy and Space at the European External Action Service in Brussels, and Professor Caitlin Byrne, the Director of the Griffith Asia Institute. I'm Geraldine Doog. I do hope you can join me at the same time next week or online via the RN website. We'll be right back.